So there has been this growing energy that has been in this Sangha, in this room for a while now. You can kind of see it now that we have all these different things out. But it's been in the room for a long time with a lot of people. And I kept thinking, oh, we have to put these things out, make these changes during the month of May when we're talking about energy, because there's so much energy involved in this. It has been going on with quite a few people, both the facilities committee and the Sangha Life committee since before the end of last year. So I guess it would be maybe around a little bit later than this time, about fall of last year. So these thoughts about what we could do with this space to make it both sacred and inviting for anybody that walks through the door. Sense of community would be here. So all these people are talking, the energy is coming. And I thought, oh, well, we should have it during the month of May. Energy? Producing something, it should be in May. But now that we're in June and we're talking about patience, I totally understand why it's in June in patience. Because there's something you might notice in all these changes that you see is that it's not complete. So you may look over at the pictures, and some of those pictures are pretty bad. You might think, oh my gosh, should get some better pictures. These are teachers and we got these, you know, I just like printed it off the computer, just regular paper. So you might look at some of them and think, oh, we need different pictures. Or you might look over here and notice, oh my God, they have the bulletin boards, but there's nothing on the bulletin boards and they're not put up. You see, you can see this kind of irritation within this energetic field, this kind of not wanting or not liking within all this energy that produced this kind of excitement around making these changes so that the Sangha feels more of a community. And I realize that that is the nature of patience. And that is why patience comes after energy. Because even with all this energy that we generate around practice, what we're going to talk about is the importance of patience on the heels of that. The importance of having both the energetic field of practice and the settling quality of patience, that you need both of those. And so I'm really quite glad. But there's one thing that's really special that I have to show you. Where's Matt? Okay, so if everybody looks over there towards those candles that we have, it's very special. They're magic candles. They just turn on by themselves. They can go on and off. It's so exciting about those because I've never seen fake candles with the remote control. I thought, oh my God, I have to get those. We don't even have to bother to go over and flick the switch. It's very special. So it's this, in this quality of this specialness, this upbeat energy, we're going to talk about a settling quality that actually supports us in a way that I think we're turning the corner, is what I think. If you think about the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections, this feels like it's a corner turning. The Pali word is kanti for patience. And so, you know, I always look these words up, and as you may tell, there's a difference between the Pali and the English. We have a way of thinking of patience So I'll give you the English definition of what it looks like. It says that patient is the ability to remain calm and not become annoyed when waiting for a long time or when dealing with problems or difficult people. That's what we think of as patience. So some sentences is bearing pain or trials calmly and without complaint. Manifesting forbearance under provocation or strain. Not being hasty or impetuous. Steadfast despite opposition, difficulty, and aversion. This is what we think of in the definition of patience, when we talk about being patient. And then patience itself is the habit that gets created by being patient over and over and over. And you can kind of hear in that this kind of sense of this forced restraint. Can you hear that? That sense of you somehow, there's all this negativity coming against you, and you, with your force of will, restrain yourself and remain calm and remain peaceful. Almost like my mother would say when we were all grumbling about, you know, some holiday, we weren't looking forward to it, and she's like, you're going to put a smile on your face and you're going to like it. So you had to put this smile, or going over to some people's house, we didn't even like them, and you got to put a smile on your face while you're sitting on the couch and you can't move. You're just sitting there in old people's houses and you can't move. You have to like it. That's sort of what we think about with patience, this kind of forced willingness to put up with something. The other way I thought about it was, it's kind of a forced virtue when you really don't want to be virtuous. You really want to be a little bit more loose about it, but instead, there's this kind of forced way that we make ourselves be nice, be virtuous, be calm, be kind. That's the way English and our use of the common use of the word patience or patient. That is not Pali. As much as I have read what we are going to talk about over the course of tonight and then the practice level of this next in a couple of weeks, that is not the way the Pali or the way Kanti or the way the practice looks at this word patience. It's a little different. So all the commentaries I read, they don't have this element of force or restraint. But there is a sense that patience is different than where we've been before. So if I can take a moment and look at where we've been before, you can kind of see that patience has a different quality to it. And that's what I want to kind of talk about tonight. Most of the other paramis that we've been talking about, you can see it kind of helping us get out of the way so that this natural quality can arise. Get that sense of self out of the way so the natural quality, whatever that paramis, whatever that perfection is, can automatically arise. So if you're working on generosity, then you want to become aware of that giving and receiving that goes on in life. It's a natural giving and receiving. And the more we can be aware of that natural aspect, the more we can experience generosity, the more we can connect with this natural arising energy. It's always around us anyway. Or virtue, you can begin to be aware of conduct and the harmfulness of that conduct. And you can be aware when your conduct does not cause harm. And that awareness of knowing when it's causing harm, knowing when it's not causing harm, that awareness is what helps us begin to align our conduct and move towards less and less and less harmful conduct. Not this kind of trying not to be harmful, as much as it is being aware, feeling into that sense of harmfulness and when we are not being harmful. And that awareness is what helps line our conduct up. Or around renunciation, it's in that awareness of the impulses in our world, impulses behind our behavior, behind our conduct. It's beginning to sense into the impulses that are pushing us. And that simple awareness of these underlying causes that push and push and push, and not doing anything, just the trying to be in that place of awareness, that adds to this sense of the natural capacity for renunciation, to just be in the impulse without having to change things or fix things or make it different. That awareness that we are feeling into, that awareness of the impulse, has in itself the ability for us to practice renunciation. We talked about wisdom, and wisdom in seeing those three characteristics, the nature of impermanence, and that there's this constant dissatisfaction. Our ability, again, to be aware of that is where our wisdom arises. It isn't necessarily the kind of wisdom that you go and study and learn something about. It's more in the being aware of the natural state of things, the natural phenomena, those three characteristics, that dissatisfaction is going to be here, that impermanence is the nature of things, that it's always shifting, and that it doesn't have this personal connection to us. The more we can be aware of that, the more wisdom that begins to settle into our bones and settle into how we can relate to the world. And then finally, this energy of not actually pushing up against life and trying to make life or move life in a way that we want, but just being aware of the here and now, what is arising in this moment. And it generates, that awareness generates a kind of energy that helps us move through practice, move through our life and turn towards the practice. So it seems like all those previous things that we talked about were steeped in awareness. And the more we point our attention towards one of these paramis, the greater the paramis begins to show up around us, the more capacity we have to see into whatever that paramis is. But patience is different. It's even different in the way that people talk about it. Pema Chodron says that the opposite of patience is aggression. It's not a hurry. The opposite of patience is not even impatient. The opposite of patience is aggression. It is the desire to jump and move, to push against our lives, to try to fill up space. This kind of edginess, you can see that it's coming on the heels of energy, and there's a wanting to push our way through life. And patience is what we use to counterbalance that energetic aggression to make things right, to take this all this buildup of all this wholesomeness, and we want to push and make our life totally wholesome. It's like this push and make everything change and everything's perfect, and then on the heels of that, there's this patience. I think Ajahn Suchito gives an explanation about patience that is beautiful. And so I want to read it. It just seems to explain exactly what patience is to me. He says, patience deals with checking emotional reactions, but it's not a denial of emotional intelligence. Patience has the gut knowledge that recognizes that a problem or a pain is not something to run away from, get flustered by, or be self-pitying around. It has the wisdom to know that we have to prioritize the steps through which we can resolve suffering. It's true that it may be possible to find an alternative route to the destination. It may well be that more negotiations are needed to resolve the problem. It may be that there's a medicine that will ease the pain. But the first thing to do is to not react, to not rage, despair, or mentally prolificate. Our first effort is to draw a line around the suffering, take a step back, and know that's that. Then there's the effort to recollect that we can be free of suffering, that we can let go. We don't have to take suffering in and adopt it as final, real, and solid. After that initial recollection, we have the encouragement to investigate and then draw out the hook that snags our heart on the rough stuff of life. So what he's basically saying is sort of what the, you know that famous quote by Viktor Frankl that says, between stimulus and response, there's a gap, and it's in that gap that our freedom lies. That's what Ajahn Sucitto is pointing to, that there is a space around difficulty. And in that space that's around the difficulties that naturally arise in our lives, within that space is an opportunity to see into the nature of what it is, to see into the nature of what is what we're calling a difficult situation or a problem or a or whatever. There's something around it that if we take a look at that first, before we follow into the natural implications of trying to solve the problem, that there is something that happens. There is something to be gained from that. And that gap is where patience arises. So I thought to myself, there's three things that we have to do in order for us to access that. The first thing is this kind of recognition that we have a conscious choice in that moment. The minute something arises, there is a conscious choice that can be made. Another way to think about it is, we often talk in this practice about turning towards the difficulty. You know, that is the nature of our practice. We turn towards the difficulty. But if you take a moment and you think in yourself, how often do I actually turn towards the difficulty? I mean, how often do we intentionally practice the idea of turning towards the difficulty? If you're like me, I turn towards the solution first, and if that doesn't work, then I turn towards the difficulty. Well, I'm first going to the easy way out. It's like a habit. It's an instinctive thing to go towards the easy way out first and then turn towards the difficulty if that doesn't work. And I'm not trying to suggest in any way that we should not do that. I'm not suggesting that. I'm not proposing that. I mean, that's why I'm admitting that I don't even turn towards the difficult first. What I want you to consider, though, is not so much whether you turn towards the difficulty first, but at some point, if you do turn towards the difficulty, therein lies the opportunity for liberation. Regardless of whether you do it at the end of making several tries to fix it, or at its first moment when something arises. At some point, if that difficulty still remains in front of you, and you turn towards that, there's something to be gained there. There's something to be had there that is our liberation. Tara Brach says it this way: there are things we can't choose, but in being present, we can choose how we want to relate to them. Mindfulness is a pause, the space between stimulus and response. That's where choice lies. So somehow or another, in our practice, however it shows up, at some point, can we remember around difficulty that there is a gap here? No matter how long it takes us to get to that moment of remembering, at some point when we're pushing up against some difficulty, is there a moment when we can remember, wait, there's a gap here. There's a something here. There's a space here that I can make a choice. That place is the choice that we have in patience. It requires a couple of things. One, it requires a willingness to sort of turn towards difficulty and the awareness that I'm having a difficulty. So you sort of have to have this awareness that something's going awry and then turn towards it. And what I have found is that mostly the following the impulse to fix something is because I don't even know that I'm having a difficult moment. Something happens, it's difficult, I turn towards the whole fixing it, and then I don't know until my fixings don't work, and then I get this sense, oh, something's wrong. Then I'll turn towards it. So there has to be an awareness that you're actually suffering, which isn't always so easy to know that we're suffering. And two, this willingness to turn towards it and check out this gap. Ajahn Chitto calls this conscious choice, acceptance without expectations. So as long as we are having an expectation about a situation, a difficulty, an emotion, of the way we think life should be, there is almost no possibility to not follow our impulse to fix it. Because we have an expectation that this should be a certain way. Sort of like, I had an expectation of what this room was going to look like when everything was done, when everything was fixed. I had it in my mind. I've been carrying it for months now in my mind because I knew this was going to happen. But reality is that it is not like that. If I stayed in that expectation, I would be pushing against the way the room looks right now. Can you see that? I would be pushing against these bulletin boards not being up. We haven't got all the nameplates and the name tags that are going to go. It's going to look cute. I'm telling you, it's going to look so good. It would be finished. All the posters would be up. Everything would be done to perfection the way it's supposed to be. We can see that kind of expectation when we're carrying something. We want it to look a certain way. We want it to happen a certain way. We got the energy all generated. We're ready for it. And then something comes along and it doesn't happen like that. As long as we're still stuck in the expectation, you can see what you're going to do. You're going to push and push and push until you get what you need, till you get it the way you want it to be. You're going to keep trying to rearrange things till you make it happen, or you're going to be sitting there irritated that it didn't happen the way you wanted it to happen. Patience is when you see the gap, when you see that irritation, that this isn't going to work, that I don't like this, that energetic expectation, and you see it, and then you begin to accept, this isn't going to be the way I wanted it to be. This is this. That is that. And that ability to rest in that and accept it is where patience lies. I like to think of this as sort of like when I go hiking. When I go hiking, I always start out, my friends and I, we're happy, and the trail is kind of light. I do not do the hikes that start out step one all the way going up. We're not going to anything like poo-poo point. That's just not going to happen. So we usually go on the hikes that start out kind of slow and level and builds up towards a big, you know, elevation. So when we start out, we're usually laughing and talking, you got breath, everything's good, going along. But just before you get to the top, you start renegotiating on why did we go on this particular, you're getting up high, and I'm scared of heights, so I'm getting up high, it's getting steeper, I'm tired, I'm hungry, and then there has to be a conscious choice to continue into this hike and enjoy yourself. Can you see that difference? It's not just the awareness. It's the awareness and then this conscious choice, this willingness to turn. And I think that's what makes patience a little different here. When you have that willingness to turn into it and still see this kind of an acceptance without expectation, letting go of the future thinking towards the top of the mountain when I'm going to have lunch, and just returning to where I'm at right now. This is this. That is that. Then I have some space to keep enjoying where I'm at. Ajahn Sumedho says, of course, we can always imagine more perfect conditions, how it should be ideally, how everyone should behave. But it's not our task to create an ideal world. It's our task to see how it is and to learn from the world as it is. For the awakening of the heart, conditions are always good enough. Right? So if this is about practice and this is about liberating the mind, awakening the heart, it doesn't matter what conditions are showing up, it's always good. In fact, noticing that you're not accepting the conditions as they are is more about how we turn towards this conscious choice. So the second part about patience is that patience is how we see this second dart. So for some of you, you know this really popular sutta where the Buddha was explaining what is the nature of suffering. And he gave an example that there's two darts. First dart is like a dart that happens in life. It's a painful experience. Some dart gets tossed at you, it's going to be painful. But that the second dart is the dart of pain that we give ourselves unnecessarily. Because we have so much automatic resistance to the first start that we end up creating all this mental proliferation and torment around, why did they shoot me with the dart? Well, they did that, and I can't believe that they even shot that dart, and we go through all that drama that we cause more suffering in the mental torment than we do in the original dart in the first place. So that a liberated mind, you get the first dart, you know it's painful, but you don't have the mental torment that comes with it. Patience, this quality of patience that we can practice with as a parami, is how we see that second dart. It's how we see the mental proliferation. It's not how we see the difficulty, because we can all see the messes in our lives. It doesn't take a Dhamma teacher to sit up here and say, life is difficult, you're gonna have problems. You could say, duh, I know that. I've been living with it my whole life, because we have mess in our lives. Every one of us in this room could spend the next hour, okay, next few days running down all the mess we have in our lives, all the difficulty. So you don't come to hear a Dhamma talk to have someone say, life is hard, it's difficult, we gotta work with that. That's not what you come here for. There's something else that Dhamma points to besides this, can I be aware of the difficulties that's going on in our lives? That first dart, there's something else that Dhamma points to. And this paramis of patience is how we see it. It's how we see the mental proliferation, the onward mental torment that we do to ourselves because of all the difficulty and mess that go on in our lives, just the stuff that kind of shows up. So patience is how we're going to begin to work on that. Sharon Salzberg says, the difference between misery and happiness depends on what we do with our attention. So where we put our attention has a lot to do with whether or not a situation brings us misery or brings us happiness. But you gotta think about that for a minute. If it's not the situation and it's where we put our attention, then that makes a problem for people like me who've had a lot of bad situations come up. So I've had a lot of stuff that's coming up, and I think my life has been hard because of all the stuff that's been coming up. But as Sharon's pointing to, that I have the exact same problems in my life today that I had 20 years ago. It's not much different. I still don't have any money. I still fight with my sister. I mean, most of the drama I had in my life 20 years ago, I still have it right now. But there is a tremendous difference in the way I hold it, where my attention lies around the difficulties that I have in my life now. That's what she's pointing to. So in some respects, it's in our view, the view we practice with, the view we hold when we're going through life, that's gonna show whether or not we're actually gonna be stuck in our expectations, pushing against the world, or we're gonna open to this gap and be able to step into patience, which will create enough space for us to investigate whatever's going on in any given moment. So the view, three things. We gotta have a resolve, this idea that resolving difficulties is going to make us happier. We gotta let that go. This idea that somehow we can find the right solution that's gonna fix it, make us happy, and then we're gonna be good, that thinking will not give us the space to be able to step into that gap and see the actual benefit that patients have. We won't be able to see that our mind is the torment because we're so busy trying to seek a solution to the problem. The second thing is that all our difficulties are intertwined with this sense of self, this idea that we need to protect ourselves, promote ourselves, defend ourselves. So if we don't kind of begin to see and practice this patience, we won't be able to see just how much the self is pushing up against us, trying to control everything we do. So this turning towards patience, beginning to look for that gap, is how we see that leaning in to protect ourselves, to defend ourselves, to promote ourselves. That's how we see it. We can talk about non-self, but the ability to see it is going to come from searching out, seeking out that gap that's there, that gives us the space then to remember that the nature of life is difficult, that the nature of life is that first start. So the last kind of way that we can see this tormenting mind is that we can see the tormenting nature of the mind is one of the most, when we see the tormenting nature of the mind, it's one of the most freeing things that we can experience in practice. And I know that many of you, most of you in practice, it doesn't take that long of practice before you see, even when you're sitting, and you hear yourself going on and on and on and on and on, and you didn't even know the mind was going on and on and on about, how could they do that? I can't believe that happened. The mind is just in a massive panic, and the whole body is responding to it. You're tensed up, you're ready to fight, the whole thing is happening. It's going on in your mind, you don't even know. And then there's a moment when you hear that grumbling, that proliferation. You hear that tormenting mind. And in that moment, from practice, we let go. We just kind of relax. It's like, oh, it's thinking mind. So we kind of let go and we can feel this release. You can see the tormenting mind and then you can let it go. When you're practicing this patience, it's more than just on the cushion can you do that. It's beginning to see when you're out about in the world, it's the same kind of learning to let go, learning to let go, learning to let go. So Ajahn Sumedho says that is, we look directly into our suffering rather than try to become happy. I just think that's so special. He says that the happiness that arises from this approach is more reliable. It's sort of this idea that I'm not going to try to be happy, I'm going to turn towards the suffering, and that happiness is going to be more reliable. It takes the mind a bit to see that. So that's why it doesn't matter whether you seek solutions first and then turn towards the suffering when all else fails, as long as that suffering is still present, then you're turning towards it. That is where your reliability comes. So the last thing is that patience, it's different. And I was trying to figure out, how come it's so different, this sense that patience almost feels like there's a quality of doing. It's not a doing, because all these paramis are non-striving. But what we are doing is allowing that willingness to turn in towards something. So it brings me to this last aspect of what I think patience, the way we can explore it, look at it, look into it. And the words that people bring up around it is forbearance and forgiveness. In one of the commentaries I read, it said, patience is the practice of exercising forbearance and or forgiveness towards behaviors or situations that might not necessarily deserve it. See what I'm saying? So you're like exercising patience. You're exercising this sense of forbearance or forgiveness, knowing that the situation doesn't call for that. Somehow or another, it doesn't call for, you shouldn't forbear. We shouldn't forgive. I don't want to. But there's a capacity in patience that allows us to do that, even if we think the situation doesn't deserve it. The implications of that is that in this practice of patience, we could begin to see that the situations that come into our purview, that show up in our lives, are more of a gift than an obligation. Patience is actually the gift that we give the world. It's the gift we give ourselves. It's the gift we give everybody else, in this sense that we are patient rather than from this obligatory, okay, fine, I'm just going to wait it out until something changes, until my sister finally gets it right. I'm just going to wait it out on her. It's not that sense of waiting for her to finally get that I'm right. It's more of a sense of a gift that I give into the space for both of us to be able, actually, for the whole family to be able to enjoy the rest of that whole holiday if we would stop arguing. So it's sort of this gift that you give into the entire universe in that moment, even if I don't think she deserves it. We're going to talk about this next week when we talk about, do a summary of this and then talk about the implications. But you can think about this. There's a way that this actually brings us into a deeper sense of our appreciation for everything that happens. All the stuff, whether we think it's good, whether we think it's bad, whether we think it's pleasant, unpleasant, it doesn't matter. You can begin to see that every single situation that shows up in our lives is the place where practice lies. It's where we can look for the gap of patience and see that tormenting mind, see that actual second dart, and liberate ourselves from it. Without the difficult stuff that we don't have, without the tensions, without the stress and the overworked and all the mess that sort of shows up in life, we wouldn't be able to see this tormenting mind. We wouldn't be able to see the gift that patience actually brings us to. So His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. Well, first I want to read one more quote from Tara Brach. She says, I love Tara Brach. I have some quotes that we're going to talk about next week, but I couldn't put all her quotes in here. It says, there is something wonderfully bold and liberating about saying yes to our entire imperfect and messy life. There's something about what if it was in practice that we could walk out that door and there is no imperfection, that whatever's showing up, that's what's supposed to show up. However we're being, that's the way we're supposed to be in order for us to see this gift of patience. That there's no trying to get it right or get it cleaned up, fixed up. That with all the imperfections in this room, this is exactly the way this room is supposed to look right now, for all of us to be able to experience both the energy that's happening in the Sangha and the kind of calmness and acceptance without the expectation that it be a certain way. So I'll leave us with this quote from His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. It says, our enemy, is the necessary condition for practicing patience. We have to have something that we don't like. We have to have an enemy. We have to have a problem, a pushing thing. So the enemy is the necessary condition for practicing patience. Hardship, enforcing us to exercise greater patience and forbearance in our daily life, actually makes us stronger and more robust. From the daily experience of hardship comes a greater capacity to accept difficulties without losing our sense of inner calm. Of course, I do not advocate seeking out hardship as a way of life, but merely wish to suggest that if you relate to it constructively, it can bring greater inner strength and fortitude. So let's stop there. We'll sit a moment. But these reflections here. So I'll see if there's any questions or any comments anybody has. Yeah.
When you mentioned turning toward the difficulty, what that means, investigate?
So, I think what this turning towards, well, the question was, what does it mean, this turning towards the difficult? When I say that, you know, we're turning towards the, what does that mean? Is it mean investigate, or what is it? And I think what it means is, at some point in a situation that's difficult, a dart, you could begin to sense into the fact that you're having a problem. You know, so it may not be the first thing you notice. The first thing you notice might be to fix whatever that problem or the difficulty, whatever it is. That may be your first impulse. But at some point in life, we notice, I'm having tension here. I'm having a difficulty here. And when we notice this, I'm having difficulty, the turning towards is to just let that difficulty be. The investigation is what you, that's what Ajahn Suchito is saying, that if you turn towards it, rather than being caught in the I need to fix it, if you actually turn towards it and you just acknowledge in this kind of acceptance without expectation, we just acknowledge there is this difficulty here. I'm having it. Wait a minute. Let me just take a moment. And you have this gap where you can just be still with the difficulty, meaning that I'm not going to try to fix the problem. You know there's a problem, but you're not going to try to fix it. Just going to take a moment. In that turning towards that pause and noticing that you're having some difficulty, from the way I read Suchito's commentaries, that's what gives us the ability to then investigate. If we try to investigate difficulty without that moment of turning towards it and acknowledging I'm having a problem, then what it ends up doing is our investigation becomes more of analyzing, trying to, you know, manipulate it, and all of that doing in the mind that just keeps us spinning in the difficulty. Instead, it's this turning towards the fact, the accepting that I'm having a problem here and I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm having a problem and I'm not going to try to fix it, change it. In fact, I'm going to pat myself on the back and say, hey, I notice I'm having a problem here. So you sort of, it's that. That is what I think the turning towards is. And if you can do that, in that space that you create this willingness to just accept that you're having a problem and being still without any impulse to fix it or change it, that's when you have the capacity to actually investigate it. So we're actually going to talk a little bit more about this when we talk about practice, how we can use that energy, that turning in, to then investigate. Yeah.
I keep thinking of my garden, which is really quite lovely, but I keep trying to fix everything in it. And I find that I don't stop to enjoy it. And I keep saying to myself, well, I'm not even enjoying it. I'm always working. And I'm always trying to pull that weed or what's the next thing I have to do? And I'll find myself kind of harassed almost in my garden. And so while you were talking, I was thinking that and of course a garden is full of life and death. But I mean, it's so organic and it's really an impossible task to make it perfect, especially if it's just me, I'm the only gardener, that I really need to sit with the uncomfortable, because it's uncomfortable for me to see something that needs to be deadheaded or pulled and not go do it. But I really need to sit there with it without fixing it.
Yeah.
And because I'm really suffering, not being able to appreciate the beauty of it in its imperfection. And I think then I need to transport that to my whole life. But the garden is
start there, huh? So the comment was that she's a gardener. Let's see if I can get this. So she's this gardener, and she sees all the imperfections in the garden. And so there's all this impulse to try to fix the garden and clip away things that need to be clipped away and pull out the weeds and keep it fixed and pruned and whatever you do in gardens. I was thinking to myself, you were saying that gardens or life and death, and I'm like, oh, I think my garden would be death, death, death. So, so it's like I need to, there's this impulse to want to be with the imperfections and be with the things that aren't right, the impulse, because of the tormenting nature that you can't really enjoy the garden itself. And so that's exactly what I'm talking about. But the thing is, the gap shows up when you actually feel that torment, right? Because sitting here, you can look at the way that you are in the garden, and you can say, oh, I feel that tension. I know there's some energy around it. But when you actually see the leaf that's hanging down, you're going to run and pull it off first, right? But at some point when you're cleaning the garden and fixing and weeding, you, in the midst of that, doing that work, you will sense into the tormenting nature of it. That is when you want to see if you can stop just right there where you're at and turn towards that difficulty and have a moment. Because that awareness in that moment, feeling that, watching the body, is where you're going to have a different view and see it. Because here, you can see that there's some tormenting going on. But being able to catch that tormenting is the hard part. So you're not going to try to keep yourself from being tormented over the garden. Because that's just going to happen if you're a gardener, right? Instead, in the midst of this noticing that you're pushed into it, that's when you're going to try to see if you can sit back and relax and just take a moment in that energy, when you're in the midst of it. But that is where, that's the place where our freedom lies. That's when we see it. Yeah. Yeah.
I have an 18-year-old son.
Ooh.
I don't think I have to go into detail. But I have had that experience of being less involved in trying to make them do stuff and finding how that's the best thing I could ever do. And that's that trying to not react to him doing things that are aggravating to me. But sometimes it's just like it's so emotionally intense, and it's, I really like the garden example. But sometimes I don't understand how to deal.
Yes, so the comment is that I have an 18-year-old son. I'm laughing because I have two, thankfully, grown men son now. I've lived through my 18 years. And sons are different with their mothers when they get 18. It's a different world. Almost like you can't tell them what to do anymore. Something happened. You're just a woman. What do you mean, talking to me like this? So it's different. And so, you know, there is all of that impulse to make it right, so it doesn't go wrong. And the reason why I'm glad we're working on the paramis is because in the practice, it's this first awareness that there's not something wrong with that wanting to fix my kid or make him go or her go the right way, to fix their lives. That parental impulse is the nature of being a parent. We can't get away from it. So the trying not to feel that, that's where the problem lies. Because we're always trying to hedge our bets on how we relate to them, and it just doesn't work. There's just going to be tension. It's sort of along the same lines with the gardening. It's the gift that your teenage son gives you to help you see when this sense of impatience, when this pushing has gotten too big. That's the gift. And this capacity to take a moment in that, to just notice, I'm having some difficulty here. In that moment that you notice that, that's what gives you the capacity to investigate it. When we think, if I think, in these difficulties that we have, if we think, oh, I want to be a nicer person, I want to be calm and patient, it's sort of like with the garden with Lauren. You can't do that because the minute you see him going down a road, your natural parental way of being is going to step up first. And you may not even know that that parental mama energy is there until after you have, you know, been yelling for 20 minutes. And then something's like, oh, who is that? Oh, that's me, right? The practice is not to get mad or beat yourself up about that yelling. It's not to somehow or another judge you like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm yelling here. The practice is to feel the mental torment of that, to feel into the suffering nature in that moment. To know, I am suffering here. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. If it means that you can't talk to him anymore, and you go sit down, and you go sit on the toilet, and you're like, I'm going to sit here. Like, wait a minute. Something's happening here. And I know something's going on, but I'm not quite sure what it is. I'm not quite sure what to do with it. Okay, you don't know what to do. But you're just going to sit there and feel into it. What Suchito is saying is, if we sat with the difficulty for just a moment in time, with enough of a space, a pause in mindfulness, that the natural response of what to do, of how to be, of how to respond, that begins to arise out of this ability to be in that gap, of being with the difficulty, instead of trying to force this situation to end a certain way, so then I will feel relaxed. Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. That's what the but in order to do that, you can't judge yourself because you're yelling. You can't judge yourself because you're mad all the time. You can't judge any of that. The point is that in the midst of this difficulty, that's where the gift lies. Instead of thinking, oh, here we are arguing again. You're like, oh my God, we're in the midst of an argument. Let me go try this. Give me a moment. Let me go try this out, see what to do. I mean, something I used to do with my kids is I used to exchange arguments. Because one day I realized that I was getting weaker and weaker and weaker, and they are getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And somehow, something turned. I used to be the tough one in the house, and now I'm the wimp in the house, and they seem to be living up. I mean, my son and I had this huge argument, and I get up the next morning, and he is just singing, whistling through the house, and I can barely get myself together. I realized somehow we had to flip this. And so we just came up with this agreement that they had to argue my point as if I would, and I had to argue their point as if they would. And somehow switching the argument so that I am arguing about his right to not have to always have a curfew, to not have to check in. He's an old enough man, he should be able to go out, and if I can't trust him now, I'm never gonna trust him. I had to argue that. And he had to argue that it's not safe, I don't know where you're going, it's not, you're not like on your own right now, you still live under the rules here, and I don't want you coming in at all hours of the night. He had to argue that. And over time, we begin to realize when we could go back to our own sides, because it was kind of funny. I mean, after a while, it's kind of hilarious arguing the points. And then we could have a conversation about what's the most appropriate way to respond. But even that is creating an inherent gap in the recognizing we're having a difficulty here, where let's just take a moment and see this difficulty a little differently. That's all it is. It's not about trying to fix the difficulty. And we have a way of believing that I won't have a problem unless I fix the problem. But that's not what the practice is saying. The fact that you see that you have a problem, that's the gift right there. You don't want to change it. You don't even want it to be fixed. You want it to stay in problem mode until I can have the patience to just accept it as it is. This is this. That is that. And that's it. And then you can, from that, let a resolution arise. Do you see the difference in the two? That's what you're looking for. So it's even in changing the nature of how you look at whether or not you're having a problem with your son, as much as it is. All these opportunities that he is going to create, that you are going to be so glad when he has left that house. Uh-oh, he might listen to this talk and he's like, oh, I heard. You're so happy we left. Anyway, that's more of what you're looking for, is just being steady with whatever it is. Because whatever is arising is actually the moment of liberation in practice. That's what you want to be with. You don't want it to be good before you start practicing. So, oh, yeah.
So, in recognizing the space and facing at some point the difficulty, mm-hmm. is there any consequence to avoidance? Could we condition ourselves to be avoiding if we wait too long?
So, the comment is, or the question is, in recognizing the space around patience, can you get in avoidance, get caught in this sense of avoidance? And did you ask me if there was any benefit or consequence to being in this avoidance? And actually, I think that is what I would consider spiritual bypass. I think that is where we get into our spiritual bypass, right? So there's a difficulty, something that's very painful, unpleasant. And we want to be all nice about it. We want to be kind. It's this leap over here to, I want to be able to hold all my problems like a Buddha, float through life, not touch the ground, be really good, very generous. People are going to look at me and say, oh my God, you're so wonderful. That's what we want to be over here. But right now, I'm about to swing on somebody. So there's a way that we don't want to feel that sense of what it feels like to be so enraged I could hit someone, right? We don't want to feel that. We want to feel this, oh, look at Tori, she's so beautiful, oh, so wonderful. That's what we want to be. So avoidance is that way that we kind of sidestep that energy and put ourselves over here in this fake way. So then I'm very nice, very kind. But I don't really feel any of that pain. You can tell if you are avoiding, from my perspective, two ways. One, if you shut pain off and you are like feeling all this pain and then it's gone and it's all good. Look, people say all the time to me, they're like, I was in all this deep pain and then it magically disappeared. So my thing is, if it magically disappeared, sort of like our candles, then you want to know how come that happened. How come it disappeared? It's looking for what happened to it, because it's not magic. It's very much the nature of things. And it may have just in your practice disappeared. But you want to be able to say, I watched the arising energy and then I watched it fade away. So I'm paying attention to it the whole time. Not that it was there and then, oh, it's all gone. The second thing is that if you are caught, we can sometimes get so caught in some emotions that we are forever spinning in that emotion. You're actually in the story, not in the felt sense of it. And so we avoid the felt sense of it by staying in this kind of mental proliferation about why I was so wrongly treated or whatever. So if you're in a story, or if you somehow or another can't articulate to yourself what happened to that discomfort, that is how I think you're avoiding it. And you're trying to figure out a way to really not feel the uncomfortableness of the problem. But that's where you want to stay, is in the rub of the problem. And there is a way that the third noble truth is going to come up through the cessation of difficulty. But that third noble truth comes after you see the true cause of that difficulty. And so that's what you don't want to avoid. You want to see how you are causing your own mental torment. And that you're going to see if you just stay with it. You see the difference? Yeah, that's good. Well, we better stop.